Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, you wonderful humans. Welcome to episode 14 of Shifting the Paradigm. I'm Christina Gomez, your hostess for this next hour of adventure and UFO shenanigans, where we look and think outside the proverbial box, jump down rabbit holes, and where the red pill is actually a red Tic Tac. If you haven't had your paradigm shifted, get ready. Tonight, I am joined by writer, investigator, and the Debrief co-founder, Micah Hanks, and someone else also pretty special. With more than a decade in podcasting, travel, writing, and research, and the study of history and science, Micah Hanks has more than just a passion for knowledge. His study of world history, culture, and philosophy over the years have helped shape his outlook on current events, and always with a nod to the lessons history can teach us. Micah is a lifetime advocate for scientific research into unidentified aerial phenomenon, UAP, more commonly known as UFOs. He is an affiliate member of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, SCU, as well as a frequent commentator and writer on the subject, and maintains an interest in the history and possible scientific explanations for aspects of the phenomenon. Please welcome with me, Mr. Micah Hanks.
How's it going? Good to be here.
It is good to see you. How are you?
Well, I'm suddenly a whole lot better. You know, we've been so long overdue for this, and I'm sure you were like me. You were getting tired of all of the interactions only being in meetings. We were the only ones that show up wearing ties. And of course, the occasional
bow ties,
Instagram.
Especially.
Yeah. Bow ties are cool, you know. and ladies and gents, let me tell you, she has some fine bow ties.
We were
so long overdue for a chat like this. And, you know, let me just say right here at the outset, I know we've got a lot to discuss, but I'm going to put you on the spot right here at the beginning and just tell everybody what a fantastic job not only you do on your channel, not only that you do for this community, but also that you do for the Debrief, which, you know, that was a kernel in the back of my mind 2 years ago. And I called Tim McMillan up and I said, look, man, I got a crazy idea. And to see where this has gone since then is pretty amazing. But again, you have been such a huge part of all of that. And again, I think that the reception you have received from the UFO community, from people on social media, from our team, it all shows, really, I think, the talent and potential that you possess and which you put on display every week when you do one of these. So truly, I'm humbled to be here with you tonight. So thank you so much.
Well, it's an honor to be here with you and our friend, Jimmy Church, who is also your friend. So we had to bring him in. We had to bring him in today.
Well, if it isn't my arch nemesis, James W. Church.
My man. How are you, Christina? How are you, Micah?
Hey, brother.
You know, it's an honor and a pleasure. And thank you, Christina, for the invite. And I get to come in and step all over Micah. But listen, I'm gonna make this brief. I've got a show to do tonight, so I'm gonna do a shameless plug. After you guys are done, and the audience here and everybody, I see everybody in the chat, shoot right over to Fade to Black, because tonight I have Ross Coulthart from Australia on the show. Big event tonight.
I'll be there.
And then, yeah, and then after that, I know you are. I know, because she said she was going to be there. And then this Saturday, a very big event that we're doing with Lou Elizondo, Richard Dolan, Linda Moulton Howe, Nick Pope, Billy Carson, and myself. We're all getting together for this live stream. And I've been preparing for all of this this week and today. And this was coming up tonight, Micah, and I told Christina, I've got to jump in. I want to see Micah's socks. I want to know what he's wearing. And to share with everybody some breaking news.
Oh.
The breaking news is this. The classified section of the UAP Task Force report, vetted and confirmed through three official sources today, by John Greenwald and the Black Vault, is only 17 pages.
Well, this is news to me.
Yes.
Goodness. When did this drop?
17 pages. 17 pages. And you know what I find interesting about this is all of the reporting, and certainly the stuff that I've done, and Micah, yourself, and Christina, everybody over at The Debrief, and Tim McMullen, and all the chatter that's been going on about it, and including the guests on my show, the numbers have always been 70 pages, 74 pages, 78 pages. I had Danny Sheehan on the show earlier this week, and he said 400 plus pages.
What?
And I'm not really sure what is going on. I'm going to discuss this tonight with Ross, certainly when he's on the show. But what I find interesting is I always felt that, and I'm going to say this very directly, that the public version, the unclassified version of the report, being 9 pages, actually 6 or 7, you know, if you count the title page and the annex.
Appendices, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. it seemed preliminary to me.
Yeah,
it didn't have a whole lot of information. In fact, it had a lack of information, and it seemed to cover a lot of stuff. Should have covered a lot of stuff that couldn't have been done in 180 days. It seemed impossible to everybody. And then the classified section of the report, if it's only 17 pages, feels to me to be preliminary, that there must be something else out there that is coming. But 17 pages covering 144 investigations, right? Seems a little bit thin to me. Yes.
Just a tad thin.
Yeah, you would think.
While we're on that, I want to get both of your thoughts on the 180-day Pentagon report that was released to the public. What do you think about the report?
I'll let Micah go first. I haven't spoken to Micah about this.
Yeah, that's funny. Usually we're in touch about this, but I mean, we of course speculated plenty prior to it. And, you know, sure. Jimmy and I have to say, we've been looking at this kind of stuff for, I mean, the better part of actually probably more than a decade. So as far as the 180-day report, first of all, full disclosure, Christina, before we took to the air, you know, I mentioned to you, you know, that I too had seen this information coming down the pipe from John. John Greenwald always does incredible work. I was very surprised to see the 17-page teaser. Now, I haven't seen it, but I mean, John, talking about there only being 17 pages, because like you, Jimmy, I'd also heard that the lengthier report would probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 pages. And for there to only be 17 pages summarizing, like you say, 144 incidents that are referred to in the 6 pages, not including the appendix and the cover page on the 9-page report that was publicly made available, you know, that seems pretty flimsy, doesn't it? Now, what evidently we can read from this is that the information that is being gathered by the intelligence agencies does not appear to be, obviously, in the preliminary report that was made publicly available. It doesn't appear to be in the 17 pages that was delivered to Congress either. There seems to be a whole lot of data that is not being released for a variety of reasons. No doubt this having to do with reasons of national security, probably interdepartmental communication between agencies. I keep coming back to the fact that Brian Bender at the Politico had reported prior to the release of the report that those who were familiar with the matter had said that they were concerned, the UAP task force, that they were concerned that they were being stiff-armed. That had been the terminology used by Politico. They weren't getting access to the information that they were actually requesting. And further, the short period of 180 days that they were given to actually compile this information for the report, in likelihood, and a lot of experts and analysts have pointed this out, it wouldn't have probably given them enough time to actually request the information for it to have gone through vetting and declassification, review, and other information processing that would have been requisite for it to be delivered in time for the June 25th deadline. So all that to say, I don't think we've seen all the information. I don't think Congress has seen all the information. There's probably more information pending, and it's anybody's guess when or if we're going to see some of that. But of course, with what's been outlined at the time of the release of the report, that of course indicating that the UAP task force is going to expand and continue somewhat. NASA even put up that new fact page about its study of UAP. Kathleen Hicks issued a memorandum. All this, of course, we reported there at the debrief. This seems to indicate that we could hope that there will be more coming on down the road. But again, is it going to be another 10-page report telling us that there are 200 new instances that they've looked at? When will we actually see the data, if we ever see it?
And the other important part about this, and I agree with you to answer Christine's question, the report was very thin, wasn't conclusive on anything, really, except for the deflated balloon incident. But this is the deal. We're talking about interagency communication here. How do you collect that? How do you vet the data? How do you investigate it and communicate with all of these different agencies and branches of the military? There's that. But there's another part to this. In these 17 pages, and this is probably the most important part about all of this, Micah, was there photographic evidence referenced in those 17 pages? Were there videos and linked videos in those 17 pages? Is the 17 pages just copy, right? Is that what it is? Is it just verbiage? I think that's a very important part about what was considered classified. I don't know about sources and investigative techniques that they don't want to reveal and make those public. I can appreciate that. But 17 pages. So what was in those 17 pages and what was directly referenced? So you could do 17 pages if you had 10 pages of video links, right? Of photographs, and links to photographs. How is all of that put together? And now I know that John, I spoke with John at length today about all of this. He is pushing hard, and nobody pushes harder than John Greenwald when it comes to this. I can certainly say that a lot of where we are today, the Navy classifying UAPs in the videos, all of the references to Lou Elizondo and ATIP and everything else that has come out of the Pentagon was John pushing the issue. The stuff would have not come out of the Pentagon if John wasn't there doing all of this over the last 3 years. And I've covered all of it. That being said, he is pushing to get these 17 pages released. Redact what you need to redact, you know, remove what you need to remove. But what is in these 17 pages? And he's going to continue to push, and hopefully we're going to see, you know, granted, some of it's going to be blacked out with a Sharpie.
Probably a lot of it.
We will see something of those 17 pages, I think, very soon.
you may see a lot of blacked out pages. Now, granted, I mean, I hope that there's a whole lot more, but I mean, you know, and John, of course, in his first book, and those who haven't read it, check out, John's fantastic books that chronicle his work there at the Black Vault, and you can find those at his website. But he and others, of course, will point to the cause situation, right? The Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, where an actual lawsuit against the NSA was attempting to release NSA documents regarding what they had at that time about UFOs. This was decades ago. And even the affidavit that was provided to the district judge who ruled in favor of the NSA in the interest of national security, even the affidavit at that time mostly was redacted when it was released. And then a later edition of it, you know, was released with fewer redactions. And now you can read a mostly unredacted version decades later online today. You know, I think that there's a copy archived at the website of the Federation of American Scientists. So, you know, again, looking at that as one example, my guess would be that, again, yeah, we probably sooner rather than later, and for all we know, John may already have it. You know, John has really been persistent about this. And, you know, I'd heard, of course, that he had been trying to get this. I mean, the minute that the preliminary report dropped,
he filed right then.
Yeah. And I don't doubt that there are other people, too, who are trying to get it. John may already have it. He certainly knows that it's 17 pages long. And if that is released, I mean, my guess would be, yeah, there's going to be significant redactions for now. But that probably won't remain the case. And again, the thing to keep in mind is even if they release the report and the entire thing's redacted, I mean, Jimmy, you probably experienced this. I know that, you know, Tim McMillan and I have had this happen numerous times where we request a file on something sometimes decades old, and we get the file, they'll release it, but it's almost the entire thing, if not literally the entire thing, is blacked out. Now, there are different processes that one can go through the FOIA in order to try and obtain those documents. And if you, I mean, we won't geek out on FOIA right now. Let me just say that there are things that one can do. We won't do a whole primer on it. Right. But again, even if the document as it is released now is primarily or, you know, mostly or entirely redacted, that doesn't mean it will remain so. But keep in mind also that we're supposed to be getting ongoing updates from the UAP task force on down the road. They're supposed to continue to report to Congress. Any way you look at it, no matter how you cut it, in my opinion, this is a really exciting time to be involved in this kind of research.
Yeah, I've been waiting for this for a long time. And Christina, you jumped on the scene. Perfect timing.
Jumped on the wave as soon as I was going up.
Oh, man. Mike and I have been at this for a very long time, and I think about the conversations that Mike and I have had over the years. I'm going to say that I'm going to throw Micah under the bus a little bit. Micah at one time used to make me really angry, and because he was a skeptical skeptic. He was more skeptic than a skeptic.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When it came to the UFO subject, because he's an intellectual, he's a historian. His background is about that. And he has always been very pragmatic and very black and white in his approach to the subject. And we used to butt heads. There was a couple of, I was just like, man, Micah, but he's not the same now. Micah, you have changed. These are exciting times, man.
Yeah, I may have changed some. I mean, I've always been skeptical. I'm still skeptical. But I wonder sometimes if it's so much that I've changed. And I think you would agree to this point, Jimmy. I mean, I think that really the way that culture looks at the phenomenon has changed.
Right.
I think that the way that the government is addressing and treating its proactive efforts suddenly at looking at this at this phenomenon, whatever it is. You know, and again, that's the old skepticism in me. A lot of people are given toward hypotheses, which are merely that. Sometimes they're less than a hypothesis because a hypothesis is supposed to be an educated guess. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people these days that are like, there you go, aliens, you know?
Right, right.
But
right.
You got to pare back on it. And again, you know, this is calling back to so many conversations we've had. But, you know, again, Jimmy, to your point, I remember John and I coming on late night radio with you, across the nation, when the three videos were dropped. And this, by the way, the official authorized release by the Pentagon in spring of last year. And talking about the magnitude of that, again, they're being very transparent, seemingly so. And yet look at the cultural side of that, where the Pentagon just acknowledged their videos of unidentified flying objects. They don't know what they are, but they've said, we don't know what these are, and they're real. And people are kind of like, yeah, we've seen those already. So, you know, again, the government attitude has changed. The public attitude has changed. There's been a gradual warming up. And I think that there's also been this attitude that we're slowly beginning to finally see, where scientists, many of them, are coming out and saying, look, this is significant. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, but we need scientists looking at this and seeing what's going on. That is essentially what I've been saying for years. Jimmy, you have been too. A lot of people have. Now, there are going to be those, and they're going to continue to be those, who say, in the truth embargo, and again, I'm borrowing that catchphrase, that famous one from Stephen Bassett. He has worked and worked and worked. I've got to admire, you know, Bassett and the work that he's done. But if you talk to Stephen, as we have, he's going to tell you, look, UFOs are alien. There is no other explanation. Any of this talk about UAP and all the stuff they might be, that's just nonsense. It's a waste of time. We know the government needs to release what they got. That's his take on it. You know, I'm not to that point yet. So again, I maintain some of that skepticism, but I will say that a lot of the climate around this discussion has really changed. And I think that it has been mostly positive change.
Yeah, and Micah, Christina, thank you for letting me jump in tonight at the front of the show. You guys have a lot to talk about. These are crazy times. And I've got to jump out of here, get a sound check done, take a breath mint, you know, clean the stuff out of my eyes, and get Jolly ready Rancher. For a show tonight.
Get your Jolly Rancher going, boy.
You remember that, don't you?
Remember that.
Micah, thank you so much. Christina, don't change.
Thank you. It's an honor for you to be here. It really is.
Thank you guys so much. Everybody in the chat room, I'm following. I'm seeing what's going on. You guys behave, and I'll see you later on tonight on Fade to Black. Thank you guys so much.
Much love, brother.
Soon. Bye.
The man. Well,
what a treat. What a treat to have Jimmy Church just jump in the live stream.
Yeah.
It was exciting. It was exciting.
I'm literally speechless now. You know, I mean, the energy of being here with him down there and you right there, wherever you are, you know, it's just a little overwhelming, honestly. So
just a tad. Well, I have another question when it comes to the 180 day report. What do you think should be in the report, which isn't in it? I guess, I mean, is there some level of guilt by omission? And what was really left out of this report?
Well, you know, I was talking with a astronomer from Arizona State University, Professor Chris MP, earlier today. And, you know, I really applaud him because he is one of the few astronomers who I have seen. I mean, there are plenty of people who are weighing in on this. You know, Seth Shostak, of course, has, you know, been on a lot of the shows and has been making a lot of the cycles. Neil deGrasse Tyson also. Where I take issue, of course, with their responses is that they, you know, they've looked at the report and they say, you know, not a whole lot to see here. To his credit, Neil deGrasse Tyson, of course, has repeatedly said, well, I'm glad our government's looking at this, but, you know, I'm going to need to see more than blurry pictures. He always defaults back to the blurry pictures. So the issue for me with regard to the response from most scientists, you know, has kind of been they continue to sort of keep this at arm's distance, most of them, but not all. Now, Dr. MP, back to your question. When we spoke earlier today, he said, notably, what we don't see in the report is any mention of the word alien or extraterrestrial. Now, that's not surprising because, I mean, I actually would agree that based on the data that the UAP task force evaluated for this report, and given what we discussed while Jimmy was on the call, the fact that a lot of this information probably that the UAP task force was actually asking about probably was not obtained in time for the release of the report and or was not conveyed to Congress for various reasons. Let me give you a brief example of the kind of thing we might be talking about. Former DNI John Ratcliffe, going on Fox News several months ago, comes on and talks about how we've got satellite data, you know, all kinds of sensor data, multiple sensor data. So he's referencing some of the things that we hear referenced in the report in writing, but we didn't see any satellite imagery. And of course, we didn't expect to. Obviously, he references there being a visual component that the American public has not been made privy to. And so that is not in the report, in addition to, of course, any mention of what a lot of people had hoped, but which I didn't expect to see. So as far as what should be in the report that we didn't see, I mean, here's the one thing I would ask. I have full respect for national security and the necessities that our government has for the withholding of certain information. But what I would simply ask is provide some details about at least a few of these incidents so as to give us at least a general idea of what we're looking at. We know, like Jimmy had mentioned, there was one incident of 144 that they looked at. Right. That they said was a balloon. So we know one of the things that they identified, but all the unidentified phenomena, all of the observed phenomena that they couldn't rule out as being, again, something else, somebody's. There's no actual information provided that even gives us any kind of context for what exactly they're looking at, what they're collecting information on. Now, they do say, for instance, that there appear to be radio emissions from some of these objects. They talked about what might have been acceleration and, you know, some of these kinds of things, but that they need to do further studies in order to be able to really ascertain that. So apart from, you know, a few references to what some of the mechanics of the phenomena or objects or technology might be, there was really little else said. And that's what I would really like to see in the report. So again, there wasn't anything groundbreaking. There certainly weren't any images. What I'd like to see more of is some actual descriptions. If all they're going to give us is, you know, wording, give us some descriptions of the phenomena you're studying.
I couldn't agree more with that. And do you think that even just having the report removes stigma?
Oh yeah.
Of the topic?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it definitely does. And I'll tell you why, because, you know, again, one of the reasons that so many in the scientific community, and you'll always see I come back to this, I think it's very important that we see scientists looking at this phenomenon. It's important that the government's looking at it. And of course, the government employs scientists to look at this phenomena on their behalf. And of course, government employees in the sciences. So it's not like there aren't people already who are qualified scientists who have probably at various levels had access to some of this information. That's pretty clear at this point. But, you know, again, I think that by having a government report on UAP released to the public, you look at the reasons that traditionally the scientific community has always been very wary of discussing UAP. Or, you know, again, as I like to say, the artists formerly known as UFOs, they went through this rebranding kind of thing, you know, a makeover, right? So,
if you like, we're shopping at McDonald's or something, trying to get that rebrand.
I mean,
I get it. I really do. It's insane how they are trying to change up all these words to give it some kind of different spice or something. Like we're shopping at a restaurant, like we're ordering something, and that's what I don't understand. Quick thing. What I want to say is I want to say thank you to John so much for the super chat, which really supports my work here. And he has a question for you, Micah. Mm-hmm. And it says, what are the actual chances of the government actually admitting that non-humans are here and always have been? And can they whole-scale keeping their beloved means methods secret? They might not even admit abductions, missing people.
That's an interesting question, and a little bit to unpack there. You know, the idea that there's a non-human intelligence associated with UAP, I mean, has really been a long-held contention, and this going back to the very early days of UFO studies. Again, if we go all the way back to the late 1940s, predecessors to Project Blue Book under the newly established U.S. Air Force, keep in mind, prior to that, it had been the Army Air Force, and it becomes its own branch of the military. I believe in 1947, coinciding with the arrival on the cultural scene of the modern UFO era, right, with Kenneth Arnold, Roswell, you know, and a lot of other things. So even in those early days with Project Sign, one of the earliest U.S. Air Force studies of unidentified aerial phenomena, not the earliest military study anywhere in the world. In fact, as early as 1946, the Swedish military had been involved in studying these so-called ghost rockets, these objects that were observed over Scandinavia. So other governments around the world had already begun to take notice of this, and they couldn't explain what apparently was going on. U.S. inquiries were also made early on about the Swedish military's interest in these phenomena seen over Scandinavia, but there was no official study by the U.S. carried out until the 1940s with Project Sign. And one of their early determinations, and this is not almost infamous, so famous that it's almost infamous because we haven't ever seen the document, but there was an early document that was released that has been referred to as the estimate of the situation. The estimate was interesting because what it seems to, and again, how we know about this is that Edward Ruppelt, who went on to become the first chief of the Project Blue Book, which was the third iteration of the Air Force's ongoing UFO studies beginning in around 1952, Ruppelt would eventually come out and say, you know, for those who had seen the estimate and who had read it, one notable takeaway was that it seemed to be very open to the idea that these phenomena that were being observed were extraterrestrial. They couldn't account for this being any kind of Soviet technology or anybody else. And at that time, there were simply no other world powers that really would have had the wherewithal to be able to create some kind of highly advanced technology. So, I mean, as early as the 1940s with Project Sign, I mean, assessments of this phenomena indicated that, well, we can't identify it. We don't know whose it is, and we don't think it's, you know, anything of ours, nor could an enemy necessarily have this either. So again, I think that from the very early days, we can recognize that the possibility seems to have been right there on the table that this represented something much more exotic. The problem was when that estimate was delivered to the top brass there at the Pentagon, they were like, no, no, we reject this. This is nonsense. We're not going to accept space aliens. So take your report and, well, you know, you know the rest of that sentence. I don't think we can say that for a family-oriented program like this. But anyway, so what happened was all copies were ordered to be destroyed. And to our knowledge, none exist. And so that's the problem. We know through secondhand sources like Ruppelt about the estimate, but no copies exist. No one has ever seen it. There have been repeated attempts through FOIA to try and access that. There's no evidence that that any copies survived. And the subsequent U.S. Air Force program that follows Sign adopts a very similar attitude to the top brass in Washington with Project Grudge, very appropriate name there, aptly named. Grudge, of course, made no bones about the fact that it was trying to downplay these UFO reports. But again, that didn't seem to be the full story either. And with Blue Book, we saw, and this is significant for a couple of reasons, which we'll get to in a moment, the lengthiest government study in the United States government, at least, this is the lengthiest government study, a systematic study that analyzes UFOs for almost two decades. That's significant, obviously, because they're studying UFOs. They came to no conclusions apart from A, there didn't appear to be a, you know, any kind of a threat represented by these phenomena. They certainly couldn't identify all of these, and they also didn't really see very much, you know, merit to the continuing study of them. But the interesting thing about that to me is that there were some 12,000 or so reports that were logged. About 700 of the Blue Book reports from that period remain unidentified. And yet, in the recent report that we saw delivered to the ODNI, they're saying that the Air Force has a relatively recent history of involvement with the subject, and they didn't look any further back than 2004. But really, they state in the report that the majority of the information that they've analyzed was collected in the last 2 years. So I'm asking, you know, I mean, should we really just toss out the longest systematic governmental study that collected data on these purported phenomena in history, anywhere in the world throughout time? Should we throw that out and say, guys, we're completely going clean slate? But apparently that's what the government right now is doing, looking no further back than 2004 at this phenomenon.
Well, at least so they claim, right? We don't really know if that's the case. What I want to know is, what in Micah Hank's perfect world would you like to see happen in the future in regards to more transparency and public accountability within the UFO mystery?
Well, you know, again, really, I think that the very best scenario at this point would be some mechanism where scientists in the civilian sphere, okay, the academic community, can become more involved in the evaluation of this phenomena. And by that, I mean involved both in terms of collection of data independent from government, but also in a capacity where they may be able to review data that the government is collecting. I think this is really important for a few reasons. One of them, yet again, we go back to history, okay? Prior to the closure of Project Blue Book, when the when Edward U. Condon and the so-called Condon Committee, otherwise known as the University of Colorado UFO Project, when they decided that based on their review of the Blue Book data that there was no benefit to science, let alone the Air Force and taxpayer money being thrown at studying UFOs, when they said that there was no benefit to it, a popular misconception was that science determined there was nothing to UFOs. Well, that's not what happened. That's not what Condon said. In fact, he reiterated after the Condon Committee's report was actually published, he said, "We never said that UFOs should never be studied again." He said, "We don't see a benefit right now at our current level of science, you know, our understanding, our current level of advancement." But he said, further on down the road, it very well may be the case that with new technologies, you know, with broader understanding of nature and you know, physics and astronomy and a host of other, you know, related or at least tangentially related scientific disciplines, it very well may be that a few decades on down the road, this is a topic that should be revisited. I mean, Condon said that a few times. And a lot of people seem to have forgotten that. But again, here we are decades later. We've got, you know, again, very sophisticated tracking technologies like the Raytheon Company's Atflir targeting pod, which, again, our Navy fighter jets have. And again, I often see astronomers and others today saying, isn't it a little curious that only our Navy, only a specific kind of aircraft can capture video of these things? And I'm thinking, well, no, that's not strange if you consider the fact that these fighter aircraft are equipped with the specific technology that was utilized in the capture of these objects, which were purportedly moving very quickly. And that's what the Raytheon Atflir targeting pod is designed to do, to be able to lock onto a fast moving target, you know, collect all kinds of data, including heat signatures. You know, this is a whole lot more than just an infrared camera. And yet I also see that being thrown around very loosely in the terminology. Oh, you know, they caught a, you know, a FLIR camera image of one of these things, you know, and it could be anything. It could be a, you know, distant 747, could be a friendly F-18 a little closer. And I'm like, well, no, not if we take into consideration all the range of information that is being collected by that device. And online representations that claim to replicate what these videos show, I think where they fail is they were not made with the same sophisticated tracking technology at the disposal of the Navy right now, okay? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that whatever's in these three main videos that everybody's seen at this point, and I do suspect that there are others, but that doesn't mean that what's in those videos is alien, okay? But I do think that what it represents is sophisticated technology that was able to discern something in the environment which we have yet to identify, and that's exactly what the Pentagon has said. We class the objects in these videos as unidentified. Right. Now, coming back to Condon, why that's significant is because now, like Condon predicted decades ago, we are armed with technical capabilities, you know, maybe a broader understanding of the sciences in general, all of these things that are applicable to, I think, a renewed effort towards studying UAP. He was the very one who early on said, maybe we should do that a little later on down the road. Well, now's the time. We've got all these new toys. You know, we didn't actually take a photograph, but we actually have imaged a black hole. We've discovered gravity waves. You know, we have done so much in the decade.
The sky's the limit when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Right. And in the years ahead, of course, we'll have even, you know, further additional advancements that will help us go further with this. But now I think it would be a great time to really try and not only put the government to work on this, but really get our scientists at least some limited access to information that the government's collecting. But again, I mentioned Dr. Chris Empey talking with him earlier, and he was in agreement with me that, you know, another thing that needs to happen is that the scientific community, rather than always just waiting on government, we need to just start collecting data ourselves. The civilian sector needs to be collecting data. And one other stigma, Christina, that I'd love to see end. We talk about the stigma against UAP. Well, there's also this incredible stigma that the only data that's good data has to come from government. If it didn't come through a FOIA request, if it wasn't leaked, you know, if it wasn't something that was supplied to us in a 9-page report, it's just useless. That's not true at all. It is absolutely untrue. Avi Loeb of Harvard, you know, who you've spoken with, I've spoken with, we've interviewed him there at the debrief and everything. Harvard professor Avi Loeb did a great write-up at Scientific American the other day where he said, look, you know, guys, the skies are not classified. They're not. Scientists need to start looking at the skies. If there's classified data we can't get access to, we need to do our own data collection. We need to study this phenomenon. Now is a great time to start doing that, considering the technologies and, of course, the advancement of sciences in general at our disposal.
Well, you know, for talking about disclosure and that the public is a disclosure. Nuno is coming up this Saturday, July 17th, where people across the globe, it's no longer a national event, but it's an international event where everyone that's a part of Nuno can be on the Discord server with your state. And you look up into the skies and you hopefully try and see something. But the biggest thing, like you said, is that the public is part of the disclosure, not the government. We don't need them to tell us, oh yeah, aliens are real, which they'll never tell us, right? We place so much stigma that if it doesn't come from the government, it's not legitimate. Well, with this event coming up July 17th, it's keeping your eyes on the skies. And I really couldn't agree more with you when it comes to this kind of topic.
Certainly. Yeah. Now, of course, old Steve McDaniel and I, we've got some ideas about, I don't know, he might disagree with my interpretation, which is we put it all on a Jeep and we drive out to the Outer Banks of North Carolina and we stay up for 3 nights and 3 days waiting, watching, you know, learning. But there's that side of me, you know, the citizen science side, I guess, where I just want to get out there in the field and I want to study this stuff, which is really for the better part of the last 2 decades, what I've actually done. And the problem, however, I guess with UAP and again, trying to study it again, with all the sentiments that are expressed by scientists on this issue, accepted. I think it's very important that scientists, even if they aren't necessarily going out there and camping out and watching for these things, you know, or training their telescopes on hot spots and hoping that something will show up. I think that we have to recognize and respect the sentiment that, you know, we need to be looking, and science needs to be aware of this and be kept abreast of developments and information pertaining to this. That in itself is respectable. But now coming over to the other side of it too, and this is where Jimmy, of course, would get frustrated with me, because, you know, there's a skeptical side of me that looks at everything from both sides. You know, I have a podcast that I do called Middle Theory, which, although it's mostly news, current events, and politics, I apply that sort of philosophical middle theory to everything that I do. And you'll very seldom see me advocate one position and then not jump to the other side and say, now playing devil's advocate with myself. And it drives people nuts, because I think, first of all, it confuses a lot of people. They're looking for, confirmation maybe of something that they believe. And then they hear me after seemingly confirming and conforming to what they believe, then I'm attacking their belief and they don't like that. But I think that we have to all challenge ourselves to do that more often. And in fact, you know, in science, people always talk about verification, you know, through testing, right? The scientific method, observe something, you know, form a hypothesis, conduct testing, repeat those tests and make sure that there's a repeatable phenomena that's discernible before you actually draw conclusions. But I think it's also important to be able to falsify your data. You know, the test for falsehood is a very key component to the scientific process. And when it comes to going out there and looking for dem aliens, you know, here's the problem with that. Traditionally, they have been notoriously difficult to find because nobody knows where a UFO is going to show up. Now, there are certain hot spots. I mean, even in recent years, we've seen, for instance, Ryan Graves going on 60 Minutes and saying that almost every day for close to 2 years, we had these things flying around up there off the East Coast. And I'm thinking, I'm pulling my hair out, first of all, going, if you were seeing them every day, you know, where are the videos? Now, again, that may sound very skeptical, but it's also a very fair question to ask. Don't tell me you guys saw these things every day and that nobody was trying to film these things. And if people had been filming them, again, is this some of that imagery that Jimmy was speculating about that might be part of what the UAP task force has been analyzing? I mean, we have seen some photographs. The debrief has actually reported on a few such photographs purportedly obtained and actually analyzed by the UAP task force, which are claimed to show something, but again, they're still fairly indistinct in my opinion. So all that to say, knowing where a UFO is going to show up is fairly difficult. If that were an easy thing to do, I think we already would have, you know, pinned the tail on the proverbial donkey with this. So again, while it's important that scientists say, let's go out there and study, I recognize how difficult traditionally that has been. And we're going to have to really think outside the box to form a strategy that's going to ensure success in the future.
And also, to be a scientist, you have to think out of the box to even know what you want to research and how to conduct that research that hasn't already been replicated.
Yeah. And thinking outside the box for scientists often includes, you know, thinking of a creative way to appeal to people who are willing to fund your research. And that, of course, only if you're going to be studying something that is deemed respectable to study. Again, this is the reason why people will spend years and years and years studying things that can't be seen and which may not actually exist. You know, if you think about all the things in the universe, you know, theories about dark matter and dark, you know, again, black holes themselves, which Stephen Hawking said ain't so black, you know, black holes we can't actually see. We can observe the effects of them, and we know that they exist. I mean, mathematically, we've known that they exist for far longer than we've been able to observe the indirect effects of them, and now we've been able to visualize them only in the last few years. And those aren't actual photographs, because these things are not something that visually are capable of being represented. It's interesting, and it's a bit paradoxical that scientists spend so much time studying things like that, but why do they do it even if they can't see it? Because there seems to be a mathematical foundation for this, for the study of these kinds of things. Again, we can calculate that based on what happens to a star when it gets so big and it's so energetic, but it can no longer sustain its own energy and it collapses inward on itself, and it becomes this incredibly dense, you know, well, actually, it's used to charge a TARDIS, I believe, at that point, right? But, you know, the whole idea is that, you know, you got this super dense mass out there in space. And sounds extremely wibbly wobbly to me. But the point is that, again, mathematically, that makes sense. And it's not to say that a UFO or extraterrestrials cruising around in Tic Tacs doesn't, but it's a harder thing for us to calculate based on our expectations for the mechanics of the universe that can be observed, right? And that's the whole idea when it comes to things like when we're looking for dark energy. Even if there's something that's undetectable, mathematically, it makes sense that it would be out there, because otherwise, the way that we observe the universe and its behavior wouldn't make sense without it. But then again, there are still the critics of a lot of these ideas as well. So again, the point to me really is I can sympathize with the scientists who look at things that seem much more mundane and even maybe harder to visualize than a UFO would be. But it's because math seems to complement those discoveries, right? And the furtherance of those studies, even when the discovery hasn't been made. The question, I guess, is how do we apply mathematical justification to the study of UAP? Now, that's an interesting idea.
That's a bit hard. I mean, the great thing about math is that it has no bias.
Well, true. Yeah.
That everything else does. Everything else does. So it makes doing experiments incredibly difficult when math is not involved. John has another question, and he says, recent comments from Leslie Keene: humans are not ready for disclosure. Minds would explode. Obama says disclosure shouldn't happen. World would argue amongst each other and new religions would pop up. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't remember Obama saying that exactly, but paraphrasing what Obama would say, I believe what he said was something along the lines of, he was kind of waxing philosophical, right? In an interview where he'd been talking about, I was the guy who would show up and say to my entire staff, you know, think about all the life that might be out there and how hopeful that is, right? And in the context of how he was talking about it, Obama seems to have been saying at the time, you know, hey, there's a whole lot more going on in the universe than the little meager issues that we humans face down here on this little mud ball spinning around that bright star over there. I can sympathize with that, you know, and although some would actually say that, well, gosh, that's kind of a narrow-minded view. I mean, as cosmic and as inspiring as that sounds, Mr. Obama, you realize there's dim aliens up there, right? Like Reggie Watts was asking him about. And that's why, of course, Obama's been getting all this attention, because in response to Reggie's question on James Corden's program, he seems to have acknowledged a couple of things. One, that, yeah, he's acknowledging that our government collects information about these things. And let's see, John's saying, he said that on a different show. Yeah, again, and to John's point, after the appearance with James Corden, he was asked about this and he extrapolates further on that. And that's what we're talking about. So that's right, John. I think that, again, Obama's kind of been in the spotlight because he sort of acknowledged something that we already knew. What was less emphasized, because people seem to have taken it like he was joking, was when he said, you know, when I was in office, I went in there and I, you know, I asked around about, you know, if there are bodies, you know, in a lab somewhere, and people are all laughing, right? And I was like, I think he was actually being serious, at least partially. And that part seemed to have been missed by the audience, because, you know, Reggie and Corden and everybody are just joking. They're just laughing, you know.
Yeah, when you can hide truth in humor, and then people don't take you seriously, but it's there.
And that was probably partially intentional. I mean, it was probably meant to sort of kind of buffer it, right? So, but when, again, back to the fundamental question of what Leslie's talking about, what, you know, Obama's talking about, can people handle disclosure? Again, in a roundabout way, Obama did talk about that. I know that Leslie's more directly addressed that idea in recent days. So has Luis Elizondo, you know. Lou has a very interesting perspective on this, and I haven't talked to him since he said this on a podcast in recent days. But I believe that you actually had some correspondence with him after that. But of course, you know what I'm talking about, where Lou went on a podcast and basically said, this would be really sobering for people. If they really knew what was going on. And he was asked, you know, what do you mean by sobering? And he, again, this is the point that should be clarified. Lou said, I don't think that's a bad thing, but I think that people would really have to kind of take, you know, a deep breath. So what Lou appears to have been saying, without saying too much, which he is arguably one of the most skillful at that of anyone I've ever seen, you know, and again, I got to respect it, because look, let's just point this out. Lou, in my opinion, has done tremendous things for our country. He always is walking a fine line between what he can and cannot say. The man has, to my knowledge, never, ever broken an oath, you know, his oath to government, to service. I really appreciate that about Lou tremendously. I know Tim McMillan feels the same way. And I know that there are also a lot of questions about the extent of what he did when he worked in government, et cetera, et cetera. I'll just tell you this off the record, you know, that talking with Lou, he's never not answered a question for me when it's a question he could answer. Exactly. And so, you know, I really respect his positions on things. But again, just to clarify what he seemed to be talking about in that interview, you know, yeah, he said it would be sobering for people, but I think that's a good thing. What might that mean? That's anybody's guess. I doubt that Lou has seen unequivocal evidence that is incapable of being interpreted as being anything but evidence of ET, right? Visiting Earth. But I don't doubt that with his role with the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, that he probably was made privy to certain data that's strongly indicative of technologies, capabilities of that technology that far exceed anything that we possess, and thereby a very unique problem both for our government in terms of, again, look at what the task force report said, a challenge to national security. Couldn't have probably phrased it better. But that challenge extends to science, too. Scientists are going to be challenged with trying to understand what this is for a number of reasons, because it's going to really strain the limits of what our technical capabilities can achieve at this point. It's going to push the boundaries of our expectations, and we're going to have to be able to really have to shed our biases to really truly look at this in all the dimensions in which it may actually, in the near future, come to represent itself for us. We're going to have to look at this. And again, there may be a mundane explanation. I doubt that sincerely. But if that were the case, it's still going to be something that will require tremendous effort and new kinds of thinking, paradigm shifting type thinking, Christina. That's what we're really looking at here. So again, both for national security, and that extends to other nations of the world, not just the United States, and also to scientists, this is going to be a really big deal and a tremendous challenge, maybe the greatest that we have ever faced as humankind. That, I think, is what Lou was trying to say. I really do. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because we all stand to gain from that and move forward and progress as a species if we rise to this challenge, do we not?
Puts hair on your chest.
I need some. Gosh.
I don't, but, you know, metaphorically.
Oh, yeah. I can get what you mean, though, yeah.
But, John also says, but what are your thoughts on what Leslie Keene said, saying humans are not ready for disclosure, minds would explode? Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that? Or do you think it just depends on the person?
I think that it would depend on the person. I would like to talk to Leslie about that.
Me too. Join me in. Count me in.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I think here's my plan. You know, I think you and I should team up and try to line up some of these interviews, because I got a lot of people I'd like to talk to. There's certain people you'd like to talk to, and sometimes, you know, strength in numbers, right? We'll do it like the Jedi. We do this together. But I'm fascinated in keeping this dialogue going, but with respect to, and again, with Leslie Keene, she's a unique case in my opinion, because I mean, she, for yet again, the better part of a decade, has been doing what she's been doing right now, where she is, as a journalist, been trying to bring attention to this, credibility to the topic. Yes, she has her critics. Look, nobody's perfect, but I'm a fan of Leslie. I really appreciate Leslie's work and what she has done and how she's done it. But would people's minds explode? You know, I don't know that I would agree with her on that point, just because I think that the response to the UAP task force report, I mean, you see how people are just kind of like, meh, right? There's this resounding meh. People didn't go, God, I'm kind of scared because there could be a technology. This might be China or Russia. And if it's extraterrestrial, then we're really screwed. I mean, people didn't seem to respond with fear. May I ask you, Christina, have you ever at any point in the last few years looking at this yourself gone, I'm scared?
No, no.
You haven't.
I mean, there are quite a few abduction stories that are like pretty freaky, and I don't want to encounter those. But when it comes to like actual fear on the topic overall, I find it invigorating and not necessarily fearful. I don't feel fear.
Right. Now, you know, again, I have to say this too. I'm pretty skeptical about a lot of the abduction stuff in terms of it representing physical flesh and blood, alien, biological, you know, beings taking humans on board craft and experimenting on them. There are some abductee stories that to me, I would find very credible. The most credible probably of them all is Travis Walton. I've met Travis many times over the years. I've talked with him. We've had lunch. He has seldom ever changed any of the specifics of the core story that he tells. And it's a very atypical story from your typical abduction kind of story. It certainly doesn't conform to like the narrative that was, you know, represented by Whitley Strieber in the 1980s with his books like Communion and the sequels, or Bud Hopkins with Intruders, Witnessed, you know, and these other books. Although those are interesting narratives, and I don't doubt that there is an experience there that people have had, the reason I have certain doubts about abduction phenomena as being some kind of an actual physical, tangible phenomena is because even Whitley Strieber and others in more recent years have come out and talked about how they have had to question how physical those experiences were. Again, another great example of a you know, dyed-in-the-wool ufologist who has had to kind of pare back on that and say, maybe this is not what we once thought it was based on the abundance of literature supporting it, which I think largely that literature was conjecture. But again, Kevin Randall, who has time and time again had to say that, you know, I think that really the abduction stuff, more of that, maybe not all of it, but a lot of it has earthly explanations. Now, are there some cases, Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson, 1973 at Pascagoula, Mississippi? Their abduction has always been very interesting to me because, again, they didn't remember it through hypnosis, hypnotic regression. They don't remember that in dreams or something. I mean, they're like, we were down there fishing on the pier at 10 o'clock, and this, again, it's often described as football-shaped, but one might venture to say it was sort of like a tic-tac. Comes down, they're taken on board this thing, they're examined, they had waking memory of what happened, they're scared to death, they go to the police, they go to the newspaper. The police sheriff, after interrogating them, leaves them in a room with a recorder running that they don't know is there, and thinks, I'm going to get these guys, you know, on tape, you know, confessing to this hoax. And he leaves, and they're in there going nuts, saying, I got to get home to my wife, we got to tell people, those things are up there. And young Charles Hickson, or I'm sorry, Calvin Parker was the younger one. Calvin Parker, who's still alive today, Charles Hickson's passed on, but Parker, he was all but having a religious experience. He was going, oh God, I know there's a God up there. And this is fascinating to me because, you know, talking with Dr. David Halperin, who, again, he's very much more of a skeptical bent and thinks that the summation of the UFO experience can be seen through the lens of the traditional mystical religious experience. But again, cases like the Hickson and Parker abduction do illustrate that there is that aspect to this. Whitley Strieber's new book, A New World, I read it. I enjoyed it. But again, here he's saying in the book, you know, I'm not so sure all these experiences were physical. He's equating a lot of it with religion. And he actually says in the book, my next book's going to be about, guess what? Jesus. So, you know, there's that side of it that it fascinates me. Again, I would hesitate to call the abduction phenomena physical, tangible representations of what we call UFOs, but it's nonetheless something that culturally is interesting and worthy of discussion. I'm sorry, I think I went down another rabbit hole.
Yeah. It's very easy with this kind of topic. There are so many branches and different facets that staying on one path is almost incredibly difficult. And doing the research, I always get lost. John, by the way, thank you so much, John, for all of these super chats. You're incredible. He has another question, and he says, how do you think the energy and oil industry and financial industry would handle actual disclosure? Zero point energy makes the energy industry obsolete.
It's a good observation. There was a documentary I seem to recall that was made a few years ago called Who Killed the Electric Car? And I would say, if you want a good idea about how the traditional, you know, fossil fuel industries and transportation, extend that to transportation and other industries, how they would react to the disclosure of information about technologies far surpassing anything that we know here on Earth and that humans have attained. A good example would be what has happened in the past when there's been a revolutionary, a disruptive kind of technology that comes about and says, we're going to completely reshape transport. What do you think the big transportation companies think about that? They're like, no, let's buy it and then let's destroy it because we're going to lose so much money. So, yeah, I mean, and again, McDaniel and I were talking about this the other day. And actually, by the way, you know, I was so impressed because what he and I were talking about was the idea of a potential arms race being one of the possible, if not a likely, a possible result from the study of UAP. And I go online to see if anybody else has talked about this. And there's one young lady being quoted in the British tabloids named Christina Gomez. And that's exactly who I go and find. So again, that's a brownie point right there that, you know, so few people are talking about this. And here's my girl right here talking about it. So, but again, that is one of those potentials. Not only the idea of the acquisition of this technology and then the suppression of it for purposes of being able to control and regulate an existing industry, but also the idea that, well, if we know it exists, then we need to try and replicate it. But of course, if we can build it, well, that kind of technology would interest the military. And so whether it's the military themselves that are building it or whether it's a private contractor who's trying to, you know, build this and then sell it to the military, the potential for weaponization, and again, you're going to see this with me. I always go back to history on these things. The potential for weaponization is inherent to any kind of a disruptive technology. Well, maybe not any kind, but a lot of technologies of the disruptive variety on account of the fact that if they are indeed game changers, a government is going to try and look at this technology in a way that they can utilize this to their advantage. And even if it's not something that's directly capable of militarization, the indirect use for purposes of military gain is another concern. Again, Tim just wrote an article there at the debrief talking about how Russia might be trolling us. They put these vague images out that show like a knight, a chess piece, right? And, you know, and there's a message along the lines of saying some of this stuff isn't as complex as you guys think it is. Which again seems to be Russia kind of poking fun at the United States and our interest in UFOs. Why would Russia be making fun of the United States being interested in UFOs? Well, if we look at this map that Mick West tweeted the other day, which he referred to as evidence of a culture-bound phenomenon, plotting a lot of UFO sightings geographically do show a preponderance of UFO sightings occurring in North America, especially in the United States. What is the reason for that? Now, there are a lot of reasons that we could suppose, and we don't have time to get into right now. But I mean, among those, this could also be the fact that the United States is looking at this. Whatever the phenomenon is interested for some reason in whatever is happening in the United States. That could indicate a couple of different things. It could also be that technologies the United States has developed and innovated are more useful in observing these phenomena. But then again, if we're talking about things like radar, I mean, most world nations have that and utilize it. Are there other countries that pay less attention to UFOs? No doubt. But that's in itself an interesting phenomenon. And so, again, that to me, you know, is one aspect of what we have to look at here. But again, to the broader point of how indirectly a country might use interest in technology developed from or even just the perception of UAP to their advantage, that's already happening. Russia's already trying to poke fun at the U.S. and say, you guys and your UFOs, this isn't that hard to figure out. You know, they're using UFOs as a leverage point psychologically, politically, and otherwise to try and boost themselves up against, you know, their enemy, the United States. So if that technology existed, imagine the different ways that that could take place, the scope of the conflicts that could emerge out of that. Yeah. And again, to your point, as you were quoted in the British tabloids talking about this, you know, and other places, the potential for weaponization, you know, if it were ever to come to that point where the technology is either captured and acquired or observed and replicated, certainly is a possibility and one that should be taken seriously.
I could not agree more with you, Micah. And let me tell you, oh my gosh, this hour really flew by and I couldn't even ask hardly any of the questions I wrote down. So we will definitely be doing this again soon for sure. Okay, Micah?
Okay. See, I have to quote my favorite Time Lord. That's the problem with time travel. No one seems to ever be able to find the time.
Well, Micah, I want to thank you so much for joining me for this week's show. It was so much great information. We are going to continue this Q&A from my Patreon supporters for another 15 minutes. So that's just one of the many perks that are available for you if you decide to support me and this channel and my work. Micah, can you please tell the viewers where they can find you on the internet, social media, and where they can find copies of your books online?
I certainly will. If I may first say, though, again, please, you know, folks, what Christina does is very important. I happen to know how hard you work, young lady, and how what odd hours you keep sometimes with the work that you do. It's very difficult, you know, to be in school, to be producing videos, graphics, content, preparing interviews. There's so much work that goes into this. People watch what, you know, again, someone like Christina can do, and she makes it look easy, but it's not. It's very hard. And I know this because I do half of what she does, and it's more than a full-time undertaking for me with all the podcasts I produce.
You do so much, Micah, and you write articles and you have books and you're a busy man.
I am. But again, I know you are also. And so my humble question would just be for your listeners, you know, for the people who watch you and the people who follow your channel, please do consider supporting Christina. You know, please do consider, again, becoming a patron, as little as maybe $5 or $10 a month, if you can afford $25, $50, something like that. Think about supporting this, because what we're doing right here, these conversations, you know, they provide intellectual fodder, you know, for future development. And we don't know who 5, 10, 15 years from now might stumble onto a video that Christina produced and goes, my gosh, what a great idea. And that could be the innovation that changes the world tomorrow, you know, that could provide, you know, food for hungry families, that could provide water for people in parts of the world who don't have it, you know, clothing, shelter, you know, for people who need it. I mean, I think dialogue, discussion, you know, that is so important. And when you support Christina and her channel, what you're doing is you're supporting the furtherance of that dialogue, which is both important, but it's also fun and we all enjoy it. So please consider, you know, pledging something if you can, anything that you can, to support what she's doing. Cause I want to make sure that she stays in business here. Okay. And y'all come over here and talk with us on the Patreon channel. We're going to go and have some more fun. So my stuff you can find at MicahHanks.com.
And all the links are in the description box below. Mike is so sweet. Look at him. He's just a little sweetheart. I, again, really want to thank all of my Patreon supporters, everyone that was in the live chat today. I could not do this without your kind support, and especially all the guests that I have every single Thursday or Friday, whenever they're able to come. I cannot do it without them either. Everyone, please take care. Have a good rest of the week and weekend. And remember to keep your eyes on the skies.